All right. Good evening, everybody. Welcome back. And I finally it took me a little about a week, but I finally figured out the name of our class this semester. And I sent it in the graphic, Peeling Back the Parsha. That's what we're doing. We are peeling back the layers and layers of understanding. No more Mr. Nice Guy, no more simple understandings. This is the advanced group. We are taking it to the next level. So we are going to peel back the parsha, and I debate every week because we just read a parsha and we have one upcoming, and I'm always torn. Do I talk about the one everybody already read, since they're familiar with it? So I do last week's, or do I prep you for the upcoming? So the truth is, it's whatever I can find material on, that's the one I'll do. So we're gonna look at last week's. Last week was Parshas Noach. Parshas Noach, the book of Genesis. It's number two after going through Bereshis, the creation, and the story of Adam and Eve. We now move exactly 10 generations. A lot of time has transpired in just a week, and it's going to move at a very quick pace for quite a while. So we have these 10 generations from Adam to Noah. So now we get to the story of Noah. Everybody, I'm sure, is familiar with it. The story is that the world, the society had become so corrupt that God has decided to destroy the world and start again. And he asks a man by the name of Noah, man by the name of Noah, to go ahead and build an ark, to build the teva, as it's called in Hebrew. And this teva he built and he worked on for many, many years. And he and his family, together with all the creatures, all the animals of the world, went on to this ark. And they survived the flood. They were on the ark for just about a year, just about a year. And when they came out, the world had been destroyed, and now everything starts again. That's the basic storyline. And there's so many different aspects of the story. I know we've covered some of them over the years, but tonight I want to do something a little different, a little bit different. I'm going to read you the text about the composition and the construction of the ark itself. Anybody have any? What's it made from?
Go for wood.
Go for wood. Okay, gopher wood. Okay, how big is it?
So many cubits.
Yeah, so many cubits by so
300
many
cubits
cubits.
long.
How many?
300.
Go ahead.
50 cubits wide.
Go ahead.
And 30 cubits high.
Excellent. With one more dimension, because the Torah adds one more piece that at the very top, on top of it, was one more cubit of a certain design. I'll read you the words. Very good, Marsha. Very impressed. It's good to know that you read the Parsha. Beautiful. It's great. And folks, again, as I always say to you, read the book. It's only chapter six. We're not deep into the Parsha, into the book yet. Okay, here's what it says. God said to Noah, "The end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with robbery through them. And behold, I am about to destroy them from the earth. Make for yourself an ark of gopher wood, make the ark with compartments, and cover it inside and out with pitch. This is how you should make it: 300 cubits, the length of the ark, 50 cubits, its width, 30 cubits, its height. A window shall you make for the ark. And to a cubit, finish it from above." One extra amma, one extra cubit. "Put the entrance of the ark on in its side, make it with the bottom, second, and third decks," etc., etc., etc. Okay. I'll ask you a very simple question. Other than nice, trivial pursuit answers, forgive me, most of the day, most days I play a rabbi. For this moment, I want to play a heretic on TV. Okay? Who the heck cares? Like, of what significance? Again, the Torah is not a history book. The Torah is not just something that you pick up some information here. If it is recorded in the Torah, every word, every letter, every missing letter, every additional, every large, every small, every space is there to teach us something relevant to my life today. What is the big deal about the instructions? If I were writing the Torah, which thank heavens I didn't, right? It would look very different. If I were telling this story, I would simply say that introduction, that the world was filled with corruption and it was terrible, and God had decided to destroy it. So he asked Noah to build a very large ark, right? Very large boat upon which he and his family will go in. I don't need to know that it's 300 by 50 by 30 by 1. What difference does that make for me? Oh, and don't forget, it was lined with pitch, tar on the inside and the outside. Okay, great. So engineers among us, make a note of that. Who cares? What is the big deal? So there's a lot of commentary about this, as I would expect. But I'm going to share with you tonight a couple of insights that, as the name of our class is, we're going to peel back the layers. We really are. And I apologize ahead of time if your brain cells will hurt. I apologize ahead of time. It is not your standard understanding. So, forewarned. Let's start with something easy. What the commentaries tell us the following. Let's take a global picture of what we have going on here. The world, the society surrounding Noah is filled with corruption. There's immorality, there's theft. We're going to talk about the words in the Torah itself in a moment, but it's a sea of improper behavior, a sea of corruption surrounding him, of which Noah is commanded to build himself an ark that he will be saved, he with his family and the animals. If you can, try to picture it, that what's happening is God is telling him and giving him instructions. How are you going to survive when the society around you is corrupt? Think about it in those terms. This is not just an historical event that happened to Noah. This is an instruction what to do when we are surrounded by people and a society that is not conducive to values we hold dear. It's a sea of corruption surrounding us. The Torah tells, God tells Noah, yeah, it's very relevant to now. This is the world in which we live. Why do you think I chose it? Right? This is what should we do? The Torah tells us in Parshas Noach, build an ark. Simply put, this is going to be a sanctuary of purity in a sea of impurity. Build something that you will become, what's the word I'm looking for? Safeguarded. You have to build yourself an inner sanctum of purity to be saved from the corruption outside. Well, if you come from with that mindset to the story of Noah, then obviously the details of what the inner sanctum, what that sanctuary is supposed to be like, is very relevant. How do I build such a place? What is my ark today in 2025? So let's start simply. The ark is representative of the place that Noah lived during his time of fighting that corruption. Yes, it was almost a year. It was about a year. But if I can be so bold as to say that this is a picture of what the Jewish home needs to be. This is our ark. We need to build our Jewish home as a sanctuary that will not allow certain influences of corruption and improper values into our very holy sanctuary. This is the Jewish home. So let's look at the construction. Number one, it's built of gopher wood. Now, other than fitting into a beautiful song about a gopher, right? What is gopher wood? What's the more common term for a gopher wood? What tree is it?
Cypress.
Close. It's a cedar tree. It's cedar wood. What can you tell me about a cedar tree?
Smells good.
Can't hear you. What?
I said it smells good.
Okay, maybe.
It
Well,
preserves things.
it what?
You can, when you line a closet with cedar, it preserves the clothing that's within.
Okay, excellent, excellent. The room in which I am now teaching this class was once upon a time a cedar closet. It was one of the first things we did because my wife has so many furs that need to be preserved that we decided, well, that's just not needed. So we went ahead and we made this into a room because it was a beautiful closet. Behind the walls, actually, I think are still pieces of cedar closet. But yeah, so it has a nice fragrance. It's something that preserves. Great idea. It also is one of the tallest trees whose roots are very firmly grounded. You can understand now the imagery. Using that specifically is what we need to build our Jewish homes with. That which is firmly rooted. That which preserves the ideals that we hold valuable. It has to be those kinds of things, right? The roots are strong. It also is one of those trees. Clearly, Home Depot doesn't get their wood from it because it grows straight. Okay? I can't tell you how many times I've gone to Home Depot to build whatever it is. The 2x4s are, first of all, they're not even 2x4 and they're not straight, right? Okay, so it's not made from cedar wood. But these are the qualities that we need to have for our Jewish home. Being straight, not with crookedness. An idea of firmly rooted, preserving with the lofty values that we hold dear. But also, it needs to be lined inside and out. We've spoken about this as well in the past. The idea of being Jewish, not just as a compartmentalized way of living. When I'm doing my Jewish things, then I'm okay. And when I'm not, then I'm someone else. No, we have to be Jews, proud Jews, inside and out. Not just with a nice nameplate on the door, and not just with a mezuzah on the door. But it also reflects the Torah values on the inside. And when I go out, I take those values with me out into the world. People should be able to look at us and say, that's somebody of integrity. That's somebody who lives a certain valuable life. We set a role as a role model. We need to make sure that it's inside and out. It has to have a door. Why? Of course it has a door. Why does the Torah have to tell me that? How else are they going to get in? No, it's because we have to learn to have a door. What is the function of a door in your home? What's its function?
Separation between two rooms or
Good,
two
excellent.
spaces.
It acts as a separation, but how about the front door, which also acts as a separation?
It's
Also,
the outside and the inside.
good. It also invites. You like the idea of Abraham's tent. It was open on all sides, welcoming the homes that we build. Yeah, it has to have a door that we know that we can open and allow people to come in, allow things of value, but we also know that we have to close the door sometimes. We have to even lock it sometimes. That's all part of it. How many floors, how many levels were there on the ark, there were three, correct, Sharon? There were three levels. To me, it's very reminiscent of the Mishnah we studied in Pirkei Avot. The world stands on three pillars: Torah, Avodah, and Gemilut Chasadim. On the values of Torah, on the values of divine service, and the values of interpersonal kindness, one to the other. If you examine the construction of the ark, you find so many ideals that fit so beautifully with this about a Jewish home. But there's more. Let's peel it back even further. What are those dimensions again? Because we didn't address that yet. So you have 300, which, again, numerical value, 300 represents the letter Shin. Shin is 300 in the Hebrew numerical value system. 50 is the letter Nun. You got this, Robin? So you got the Shin and the Nun. It's important because I'm going to call on you. We got to remember these letters. The Shin is 300, the Nun is 50, Lamed is 30, and Aleph is one for that one extra cubit at the top. So you have those four letters, the Shin, the Nun, the Lamed, and the Aleph. I'm going to unscramble them, and what you get is a word that says Lishna, Lamed Shin Nun Aleph. Lishna, which is the Aramaic word for the Hebrew word Lashon, like Lashon Hara. Or what does the word Lashon really mean?
Language.
Okay, it's used for language. It's literally tongue.
Tongue.
Your tongue in Hebrew is called Lashon, but it means speech. That's why it's called Lashon Hara, evil speech, gossip.
Lashon.
Okay, that's the Yiddish term, right? We call it the Mama Lashon, Yiddish, right? It's the mama's language, the mama's tongue. That's what they used to speak. There's an entire section of commentaries, a whole group of them that focus on this idea. And that is, not only does the ark represent our homes, but the ark also represents the concept of sanctified speech, Lishna. And that's why the dimensions are the way they are. But how does that fit with all of this? Ah, ladies and gentlemen, by a show of hands, how many of you think Noah was a righteous individual? Not too many of you. Only a handful, literally a handful. Okay? How many of you think that he was really a bum? Good. No hands. I'm glad to see that. Good. That's good. The Torah testifies that he was a righteous man. But how come some of you didn't raise your hand? Because I know something's gnawing at you.
Because it said he was a righteous man in his time,
Great.
not compared to Avraham.
Okay. So I knew this was coming, and I'm going to make a conscious decision not to go down too far on this road. You're right, Michelle. That is how the commentary Rashi himself brings down two opinions about this. And yes, but my heart doesn't let me change the fact the Torah testifies and says he's a righteous man. You're right. If Tzvi Tachman was compared to Moshe, I'd also be a bum. Now, not to say if I'm compared to my brother, I'm not a bum, but I'm just saying it's not fair to compare. When we go up after 120 years, are we going to be compared to someone else and say, well, how did you do? Well, I would say Michelle's really nice, but she ain't no Sarah, right? I mean, that's ridiculous. You can't do that. Sarah and Abraham had their great qualities and they maximize. I'm not asked to be Avraham. I'm not asked to be Moshe. I'm asked to be Tzvi Tachman. That's who I'm asked to be. So what do you mean? Oh, compared to Avraham? Well, that's not fair. It's not wrong, but there needs to be further explanation about that. Go ahead, Sharon.
So the way I was thinking is like what on what Michelle said is like Abraham would have not questioned God, I don't know if that's the right way, but about destroying the people, not to not destroy the people. Noah just did what God told him to do.
Okay,
He
so
didn't
you're
ask
onto
any
something.
questions.
You're very good. Excellent. I don't mean to say that we can never compare. We always want to compare and say we should be like, we always say that we should emulate the qualities of certain people. That's great. That's a wonderful thing to do. What I think our sages are telling us is that while Noah was a righteous individual, there was still something lacking. And if you compare to Avraham, you see what it is that's lacking. He's not being compared after his 120 years goes up and God says, Noah, 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 why couldn't you be like Abe? He didn't do that. That's not what God did. What he did was, knowing what Avraham did, why didn't you do that also? What is the major difference between Avraham and Noah? There's one major difference, and that is Avraham impacted the people. How many people, if Noah is building this ark, As our sages tell us, for 120 years he's building this thing. And every day, Jack drives by and sees Noah building this in his driveway, and he goes, "Noah, what you up to?" "I'm building an ark." "Why?" "Because there's a flood coming." "Right." And he just keeps on going, right? And he does this every Monday and Thursday. And how many people did Noah save?
None.
Zero.
His family.
His family, his
And
family
now his
only.
and his family was saved not because of him, it was in merit of him. But did he impact them? No, not necessarily. How about all the people? No.
No.
Avraham was the person who was able to be effective in his speech. That's where I'm going with all of this. Avraham harnessed the power of speech to positively impact others. Even like Sharon said, to the point of where he argued with God for a place he didn't even live. When he argued with God to save the cities of Sodom and Amorah, Sodom and Gomorrah. It had nothing to do with him per se. But no, he was able to sanctify with his words. Where Noah was lacking was in his ability to use speech. Maybe he didn't even daven enough for the people. We don't find anywhere that he davened. We find Avraham davened for people. He prayed for their well-being. You don't find that Noah did. Perhaps the commentaries suggest that that is the hidden message or the hidden allusion to the dimensions of the ark because they spell this word Lishna, having something to do. He has to be quarantined inside the ark. I don't want to use the word punishment, but as a message, as a lesson that he didn't capitalize on using his Lishna, using his speech properly to impact the people. Susan.
I have some trouble with this in that he was given, that wasn't his job.
What do you mean that
His job,
wasn't his job?
how could he both attend to the job of the ark and also at the same time, he's only human.
I just gave you the example. People would see him. Noah was a well-known figure in his time. So people see him doing this and they asked him. They texted him. They emailed him. They
They said,
WhatsApped
and he
him.
said nothing to them.
They said in the Mamaloshin, Vos totzach Noach, what you doing?
And didn't he say, I'm building an ark and
And
the
but did he was he effective?
that, is that on him?
Yeah,
He listened
clearly.
in the time that he's living and with the people that are here. People have
How
to
did
be,
Avram do it?
people have.
Avram is surrounded by idol worshippers who believe in polytheistic ideals.
He
How did he
wasn't
do
asked
it?
to build an ark.
What?
His job was not to build an ark.
I think there's more. I think you're limiting your perspective. What is the function? Let me answer this better question. I got a better question. Why didn't God help him construct the ark in 3 weeks? Why did he take him so long to build it? And don't tell me because he didn't have the tools. I don't want to hear it.
I granted, yeah, hope
So
in.
what's the motivation? Why does God want him to build this ark? Why didn't God just make an ark?
To try to spread imperative versus purity.
Again, what?
It was to protect the purity of the what is going to say.
I understand why an ark is needed, but why did God make him build the ark? Let him just present him an ark.
Because
Maybe
he
he was hoping, I see where you're going. He was hoping that in the time that passed, some people could be rallied to change.
Exactly. Isn't that really what it's all about? If it was just a matter of saving Noah and his family, then he could have just done a miracle and have them fly up to Mars for the week or whatever it is, destroy everybody else and bring them back. What's the concept that Noah has to go through all of these things? And clearly, he says, let me find the verse, right? He gives him all the instructions. He has to collect all the animals. He has to collect all the food. This isn't just a, I'm going to put you in a situation to save you. God has myriads of ways that he can go ahead and save him. The act of building the ark was publicizing, similar to Jonah going to the city of Nineveh in the Yom Kippur story, right? It was a cry to the people, we better change our ways. God is not happy. If God wanted just to save him and destroy, it could have been done in a blink of an eye. I think part of the process was for Noah to try to change the people. God does not want to destroy them. That's not God's wish. He wants tshuva. He wants repentance. Okay, but let's take it even further, because the truth is, this is not my concept. Nothing I'm sharing with you is mine. The Zohar itself
No, not at all.
actually places some level of blame on Noah.
Yeah.
Okay, make a mental note of this because we're going to come back to it. But there is definitely this concept. Let's build it a little better. Let's go back. I'm going to introduce a totally new concept. Bear with me. And once we understand it, we're going to tie it back to what we're saying. Okay? But you need to really be focused. This is not a simple concept. Okay. I'll do my best and feel free to ask, but here we go. We know that for free will, which is a fundamental principle of Judaism, that we have a free will choice to choose between right and wrong. That means God had to create an environment where both options are viable. If the environment was always, you always choose the right, then you don't get credit for choosing the correct answer. And if there's no chance for it and you can only choose the wrong choice, then again, it's not fair to punish someone. So for mankind to be given the opportunity for reward and or punishment of choosing right or choosing wrong, there needs to be two viable options. Yes, so far so good. Okay. Similar to this idea that we've have these, what we call the Yetzer HaTov and the Yetzer Hara, the positive, the good inclination and the evil inclination. It's terms that we use. But there is such a concept that exists even in the spiritual realms. What I mean is as follows, and please don't misunderstand me. There is only one God. There's no question about this. However, it's not even however. For God to allow choices, that means God has to allow the opportunity for goodness to exist. We'll call it the light side. There also needs to be something called the dark side, the positive and the negative. The follow the right path, follow the wrong path. Yes? I want to be clear. When I talk about this term about the dark side, I don't mean something that is equal to God. God being the positive side, and this other thing representing the negative side, and they're two battling. That's not what I'm saying. Think of it as the pyramid. At the very top is one God that allows for two ministers. I'll call them angels for now. Two angels that are working for God. One whose job is to entice us to do the positive, and one whose job is to entice us to do the negative. Yes? I'm just going to use the term, the dark side, but it's not an equal. It is a minister, an angel, so to say, of God. You heard of Satan? You heard of Satan? Yeah, okay. Satan's on the dark side, yes? Okay, good. As long as we're all on, okay. Even if the Zoom class ended here, we know we're in good shape. As long as we all agree, Satan's on the wrong side. He's on the dark side. Okay. There is, and I apologize, but here we go. There is a primary angel that is in charge of the whole dark side. This angel is not equal. I'm going to say this 100 times, is not an alternative to God. It is a minister in God's close cabinet that allows for evil to exist, for a negative aspect, the ability to turn around and say, I'm not going to follow what God asked me to do. There's a head angel. I'm going to say his name only once. I don't want to say his name. I'm a superstitious guy when it comes to these things. I'm not interested in inviting him into my home. And I'll show it to you on a piece of paper in a moment, okay? We're going to call him Sam for short, okay? Because the first two letters of his name are Samach and Mem, which spells Sam, okay? Samach and Mem. The last two letters of his name are Aleph and Lamed, which is often the end of God's angels always end with an El, like Michael, Gavriel, Raphael. Well, this guy's name is Sam. I'm not pronouncing it the way it really is, but Samach Mem, and then an Aleph Lamed. Yes? Sid, you got the picture in your head? You got him? Okay, I'm going to show it to you. Now I'll show it to you. I can figure out how to. How do I turn that off? Come on, where are. Oh, here you are. Okay. Share. Okay, here we go. Okay, you see the top line? You don't?
Yes.
Okay. My point is going to go over it. This is a samach. This is a mem. I wrote it in the biblical, the font. Aleph and Lamed. This is his name. Okay? He's the head. He's the one in charge of all the negativity, all what I'm calling the dark side. Going back to the Garden of Eden, who is his primary henchman? Who's the primary henchman that is acting on behalf of Sam?
The snake.
The snake. That is what the snake does in the Garden of Eden. He entices Adam and Eve to partake of the tree that God said, don't eat. In Hebrew, the snake. Is spell his name is it name the word is Nachash. Nachash is a snake. Nun Chet Shin. Second line here. So you got the head honcho up here and his henchman down here. You with me? Okay.
Yes.
I'm going to leave this up there, but now I'm going to go back to the story of Noah. I want to go back to the story. The world has become corrupt. In just 10 generations, from Adam and Eve down to Noah, God has seen enough. The world has become so corrupt and is filled with, what is the Torah's word here? Listen to the words here. Vayomer Elokim l'Noach. God said to Noah, Kates kol basar bo lefanai. The end of all flesh has come before me. Listen to these words. Ki mala ha'aretz chamas. The world has become filled with, I'll say the word again, Hamas. Does that sound familiar to anybody?
Yeah.
The world has become filled with Hamas, which is translated as either corruption or more specifically theft. But that's not the normal word for theft. The normal word is gezel. It's throughout the Torah. For some unexplained reason, the Torah here uses a different word for this kind of theft called chamas. I'm not going to get political, but here's what's fascinating. In the Garden of Eden, when Adam and Eve, right? Let me say better, before they ate from it, before they ate from the tree that they were not supposed to, we're told about the story of Adam naming all the creatures. Remember that? Right? It's one of the highlights of the beginning of the Torah. And it's, he names all the creatures. And we've asked the question in the past, who cares? So he named it hippopotamus. So what? Why do I need to know this? What we explained is that it was a sign of Adam's true wisdom, such that he can identify and define the characteristics of each creature and give it an appropriate name that explains, that defines the essence of that creature. So when he saw the dog, he called it Kelev, because the letters Kaf Lamed Bet is defining what a dog's uniqueness is. And when he saw a cat, he said Chatul, because that defines a cat. And so on and so on. The Midrash tells us that the angels were upset. They said, what is this? How could it be that man is greater than us? We couldn't name the animals, and Adam seems to be able to do this. At that point, Sam, our guy, Sam decides he's got to do something. So he joins together with his henchman, Mr. Nachash, Mr. Snake. He teams up with him in order to entice. We have to do something to get Adam and Eve off of this high platform that they're on. And they're enticed with this whole story with the tree, and they fail, and the bad guys are successful. The way the Midrash explains this is, watch what happens here. Okay? Let me add one more piece. Are you all with me so far?
Yes.
Okay. This is an important piece. The Arizal tells us that nothing in our world can continue to exist without God willing it to exist. There needs to be some element, even if it's only minute, but it has to have some spark of sanctity, which is a piece of God or a connection to God, for it to exist. In other words, there cannot be something that exists in this world, anything that is 100% evil, totally impure. There can't be such a thing, because it has to have an element of sanctity for it to exist. It's not a great example, but why does anything die in our world? An animal, a person, whatever. Because its life essence is no longer there, right? The soul departs, the life essence is no longer there. In a spiritual way, nothing can exist. No angel, no person, no animal, no creature, no sun, moon, stars, oceans, rocks, nothing can exist if it doesn't have some element of sanctity connecting it to God. Now, let's take our two guys on the dark side here. Let's take Sam and Mr. Nachash. Let's take these guys. The Arizal tells us that these letters, come on. Oh, can I do it here? Oh, I can do it. Ha. Can you see me move these boxes? Okay, great. Excellent. The Arizal tells us that the element of sanctity that exists in the top guy, in Sam, are the letters Aleph and Lamed, which I understand very easily because that's part of God's name, like we say Elohim. So the Aleph Lamed represents that element of sanctity, even for the guy, the head honcho of the dark side, has to have an element, says the Arizal, the great Kabbalist. Aleph Lamed is what is the sanctity, or the element of sanctity in him. And similarly, the Nun and the Shin of the serpent is also an element of its sanctity. Okay? Therefore, it can exist. Watch this. I'm now putting a circle around the other three letters. When the world gets to a point of where there is no connection of sanctity whatsoever, an absolute corrupt society that has made itself devoid of any connection to sanctity, and you get rid of those letters of sanctity, so to say, and you take away the Aleph and the Lamed, and you take away the Nun and the Shin, you're left with three letters. If you look at it in backwards order, you'll see it spells Ches, Mem, Samach, known as Hamas. The world was filled with Hamas. The only thing that was left in the world at this point, it had made itself disconnected from any sanctity whatsoever. And all that remained was the negativity, the evilness of the dark side that can't exist and therefore needs to be destroyed. Is this too much? This is big. I'm going to take this off the screen for a second so I can see your faces, and then I'll go put it back on.
I got
What were the three letters? I'm sorry. Then.
Ches, Mem, and Samach, the middle letter of Nachash, the middle letter of the snake, and the two first letters of Sam. Spells Hamas. Now, again, I'm not getting political, but I find it absolutely mind-boggling why the name of that organization is Hamas. It's just mind-boggling to me. But be that as it may, the Torah here in the story of Noah tells us, do you know why the world had to be destroyed? Because it had not even a shred of sanctity left in it. All of the elements that even on the negative side are gone, and all that's left was a world filled with absolute corruption.
But maybe that's why it wasn't Noah's job to convince them to do good, because it would have been impossible.
Okay. Remember, at what point does God tell them to do this? At some point, they weren't at the 100%. Maybe they were at the 98%. It's not the only time. It's not the only time it appears.
Rabbi, if the Hamas does not. The letters don't have the element of God's name. How can it exist?
You're talking about the organization today?
No.
Okay, good, because I don't know the answer to that question.
No.
No, the answer is once we got to the point, that's why God says at this point, there's no saving grace for this because it's 100% evil. I need you to build an ark and find a way to get out of this because the corruption is too far gone and it is completely devoid of any connection to godliness and sanctity. That's why he has to build it. Therefore, if this isn't enough for you to just say, wow, this is unbelievable, now let's go back to that chart, because what's going to shock you even more is this little thing in the corner down here at the bottom that I left.
Right.
The four letters of sanctity were the Aleph, the Lamed, the Nun, and the Shin. Remember those, right, Robin? Those are your four letters.
381.
And you guess
Rabbi,
what?
why the nun and the shin?
What do you mean, why?
What do they stand for? I mean,
Oh, why are those the letters of sanctity? I don't know. I mean, the Arizal talks about it, but Tzvi Tachman doesn't understand. Way above my pay grade. There's some aspect. I mean, I know a little bit more about Shin than I do about Nun, but suffice it to say that the Arizal tells us that that's what it is. I'll give you a hint. I'll give you a hint. Totally off subject, but you're forcing me, Janet.
Sorry.
Are you?
No.
Okay. Switch gears for a moment. We're sitting at the Pesach Seder, and we're talking about the four children, right? The four sons. My favorite one, always the wicked son, always. What does it tell us in the Haggadah? That he says this, why, what is the service to you? What's our response? So the Haggadah tells us, Hakei Ashinav, blunt his teeth. Remember that? No, yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Not
That's what
teeth.
it says. Blunt his teeth. Take away the sharpness of what he's saying. How do you say teeth in Hebrew? How do you say tooth in Hebrew?
Remember.
Your teeth are called shinayim. Singular tooth is called shein. Shin nun. Yeah?
Okay.
Okay. You know what the response is to this Russia, this wicked child? Most commentaries learn you go back, fight fire with fire, and you tell him put him back in his place. I've seen commentaries who do the exact opposite. What we do is we blunt his sharpness by reminding him of his shin and nun, the inherent sanctity, those two letters, Janet. The inherent sanctity, that spark of holiness that still exists within him, no matter how far gone he thinks he is. Totally a different way. But the letters shin and nun, often, you just keep that in mind. I don't know exactly why, but I've seen it used that way.
Is it related
Okay?
to Neshama?
Could be the first two letters of neshama. There you go. There's got to be stuff to this. Okay.
Thank you.
First two letters of bear.
Okay, so now, so you have these four letters of sanctity, the Aleph, the Lamed, the Aleph, the Lamed, the Nun, and the Shin. Look at the little corner at the bottom. I gave you the numerical values. Aleph is 1, Lamed is 30, Nun is 50, Shin is 300. Do those numbers mean anything to you now?
The
Those are the dimensions of the Ark.
right.
Whereas the whole world, having devoided itself, no such word, having become devoid of all levels of sanctity, and all that was left were the circles, the Ches Mem Samach, Chamas. What happens? Where's my inner sanctum of Kedusha, of holiness? Oh, he builds an ark that are these four squares letters. These are the dimensions of the sanctity, the inner sanctum of his world, to be able to hold on to any level of holiness. Are represented by these four dimensions of the arc. 300 by 50 by 30 by 1. How crazy is this? As I said before, Noah was a righteous man. He deserved to be saved. Was he flawed? Clearly, our sages point out that he was not successful. He was ineffective in being able to reach people. We can come up with reasons for it. Maybe like Susan and Marcia are suggesting that the world was too far gone. Maybe. But the Zohar doesn't accept that. The Zohar holds that there's a certain element that is on him. In fact, in the Zohar, it's actually called the Mei Noach. The floods are called the waters of Noah, not in a complimentary way. It's almost as if laying blame, the waters that came about are partially to be blamed by Noah. Mei Noach. Now, why is that word significant? Listen to this. We know that a person is held accountable for things that they do wrong. We understand that. There's a judge, and we have to make good choices, and like every other everything else in life, there are consequences. Make poor choices, there are consequences. Make good choices, there's positive consequences. Well, the truth is, there's one more element to that. And that is, even if you didn't do something wrong, but if you had an opportunity to advocate for a positive outcome and you remain silent, you stand by as a silent witness to something negative, you are held accountable for that. You have to be able to speak up when you need to. We cannot just say, I'm not a fan of a book that came out years ago called I'm Okay, You're Okay. That is not a correct Torah view. If I'm okay and you're not, then by definition, I'm not either. It has to be that we have some level of responsibility. So if we see something wrong in our community, we see something wrong in the world, it's our place to speak up. God punishes those who have the opportunity to advocate on behalf of others or to admonish them and they fail to do so. That's a responsibility we all have. Noach, unfortunately, to some degree, was content with the rescuing of himself and his family. Okay, he told others of the impending doom, but it's clear that according to many of the sources, he didn't do enough. And for that, so to say, like I mentioned before, we can look at the ark as, yes, an inner sanctum, but it is also a little bit of a quarantine. It's almost a little bit of, he's incarcerated. What does he do for a year? He's running around like a chicken without a head, feeding all the animals, taking care of all the needs. It's not exactly, you know, Club Med. It's not exactly a Caribbean cruise that he's sitting back and just saying, yeah, I'll just look out. I'll sit on the Lido deck while everything gets destroyed. It's not what it was. How can Noah ever rectify? How can he correct this mistake? Well, one more interesting piece of information. And I apologize from the beginning, but your heads are going to hurt. We believe, one of the fundamentals also of Judaism, is we believe in the concept of reincarnation. We believe that souls do come back, can, not have to, can come back for a second, third, or multiple times. It's not the way it should be. I want to be clear about this. If we were all doing the job we're supposed to, then our souls would do their mission and go straight to the next world, go on to the next spiritual level. But unfortunately, the vast majority of us, nay I say all of us, don't fulfill the job completely, and therefore we need to come back and finish the job. So it's not surprising that you find in many, many Kabbalistic writings this idea of someone's soul being reincarnated in someone else later down in history. So the Zohar mentions it, but the Arizal speaks about this explicitly, and that is Noach's soul was reincarnated into none other than Moses, Moshe. Now, okay, interesting tidbit of information, but how does that work? Well, watch this. Moshe spoke up at a time where he could have kept his mouth shut. After the sin of the golden calf, we're all familiar with that story. God is very upset with the Jewish people, and he decides that he's going to wipe them out. And he turns to Moshe and he said, I'm so upset with them, I'm going to get rid of them, destroy them, and I'm going to start a new nation just from you. Now, if this had happened to Tzvi Tachman, I can almost guarantee his response would be, yes, all Jews going forward will be known as children of tea, right? I could just picture the scene, right? All that, but that's not Moshe. What is Moshe's response? No, absolutely not, God. If you're going to get rid of them, I want out. Tremendous display of leadership. It even, if I can say the words, it borders on chutzpah. But listen to the words, how precise they are. Moshe doesn't just say, if you destroy them, I don't want to be part of your team anymore. The words he says are, erase me from your book. Do you remember that term? He says, erase me from your book, God. I don't want to even be mentioned. If you're going to redo the whole nation and a whole new history, I don't even want to be a footnote. He says, erase me from the book. In Hebrew, mecheni na misifracha. Mecheni, erase me, na, please, misifracha, from your sefer, from your Torah. Mecheni na, please erase me, are the words, ani minoach. The same letters as, I am from Noach. Mecheni na. I should really have written this out. If you want to spell it as follows. The letter mem, followed by the letter ches, followed by nun, followed by yud. That's word number one. Mecheni. Next word, nun, aleph. Na, please. Mechenina. Those six letters can be unscrambled to two words, each three letters. Ani, the Aleph, the Nun, and the Yud, leaving a second word, Minoach, Mem Nun Chet. Moshe alludes to the fact that I am not going to be like my earlier version. I'm going to be Noach 2.0, and I'm going to speak up when I have the opportunity to. And I'm going to turn even to you, God, and I'm going to say, no, I'm going to abolish your decree. You want to destroy like you wanted to destroy the world, except my previous version is Noach. I didn't speak up enough. I didn't use my power of persuasion or my power of speech to try to influence. I'm not going to make that mistake again. And I'm going to speak up and prevent a destruction of the Jewish people. Mechenina, such a strange expression. Yeah, but when you analyze it the way our sages do, you see the layers of understanding and the words Mechenina spell the words Minoach ani, or ani Minoach. I'm from Noach. So where does that leave us other than out of time? Let me summarize, because I threw a lot at you tonight. I'm afraid I was too much. But the recording will be available to review, and I'll expect all of you to have this in writing, written out every golden word by next week. But in the meantime, let's summarize.
Robin's already got that
I
done.
got most of it. I got
Yeah.
five pages. Yeah.
Let's summarize. We were faced with a couple of questions, and that is why the Torah tells us what seems to be trivial pieces of information about the construction and the composition of the ark itself. Who cares what the dimensions of 300 by 50 by 30 by 1? Who cares that it was made of cedar or gopher wood? Who cares that it was lined on the inside and out? Who cares that the way or the strangeness of the Torah's terminology of the world was filled with chamas, filled with robbery and theft? It's not the normal word. And what is that Noah did wrong? Why should? What we've tried to do is to explain that the story of Noah and the flood is a symbol of what to do to build a sanctuary, to build a safe haven that we don't get inundated by the flood of immoral values, of a flood, a sea of corruption. How do we do it? We need to build a teva. We need to build an ark. We said that in two ways, three ways. One is our homes. The ark represented Noah's home, where the home is built out of tall, lofty trees that run straight, that have deep roots, that are lined both inside and out with our values. We keep the values in and we make sure to take them with us when we go out. We talked about the idea of the door being open to everyone, but knowing that it has to be closed. So that's one representation of it. But then we took it a step further and talked about why specifically the Torah teaches us about the dimensions. And we said there were two things. One is that these four dimensions correspond to four letters in the Hebrew alphabet. They either spell Lamed Shin Nun Aleph, which is Lishna, as a reference to the speech, where Noah didn't capitalize as much as he could have using his speech. Whereas, just again, tying this all back, where Moshe, who's the reincarnation of Noah, did utilize his speech properly and even referenced it when he said the phrase, erase me from your book, by referencing that he's Noah 2.0, or maybe 3.0 if there was somebody in the middle. But then we added the other piece, and that is the idea that every element of sanctity, everything in our world has to have some element of sanctity with it. The world had become so corrupt, it got rid of all those four letters. And all that was left was the dark side, negativity, no connection. It was only left with those letters of a samach, a mem, and a ches. which is the word the Torah uses, that the world was filled with chamas, was filled with this but pure evil. Hence, it can't exist. It has to be destroyed and start again. How does Noah save himself? God tells him to build an ark whose letters, whose dimensions correspond to the letters that are all about sanctity. The letters whose essential nature, as we showed, the Aleph and the Lamed, the Nun and the Shin. Those are the letters that represent sanctity of objects and things. That's the dimensions of the ark. Build yourself, Noach, a sanctuary, an inner sanctum that will help prevent, that will protect you from all of the onslaught of the sea of corruption that surrounds us. It's a lot. Maybe I'll dial it down a little bit, but I think, at least for me, I made the decision to go with it because I want to show you every now and then the level of depth that there is nothing written in the Torah that is not meant to be learned, analyzed, lessons taken from. What is the Torah telling me by giving me that information? Why is it relevant to me today? That, to me, the story of Noach is the story of today and the importance of us building a teva, an ark. I'll just throw one more piece. It's just interesting that the word for ark we call a teva, but the word teva has another meaning. Anybody? Marty, you know this. Come on, Marty. Susan, come on. What's a teva?
Word.
A word. Tevot are words. A teva is a word. Yeah. How, like, again, the word that for ark that we just got through describing was a sanctuary for Noah to learn his lesson about the power of
the words.
The ark and word are the same word. Okay. I'll give you all a chance to decompress like divers coming up from this deep sea adventure. I'll stay on a little longer. Seriously, any questions? I'm sure there might be. So go ahead, ask.
Rabbi, not really a question, but I had never seen Noah and Moshe compared that way. But as you bring it up, and I see, okay, Moshe also had a speech impediment.
There you go.
Able to overcome it. Plus, the 40 days that Moshe was up in the mount to get the Torah, followed by the 40 years in the desert.
I got one more for you while we're at it. There's only two people in all of the Torah, throughout Tanakh, all of Tanakh, who get a title Ish something, a man of X, twice. There's a lot of people that have it once. They're called Ish something, you know, a righteous man, a holy man, or whatever. One appellation. There's only two people in Tanakh who have it twice, Noach and Moshe. Noach is first called in the beginning of the parasha. He's called Ish Tzadik, a righteous man. And after he gets off the boat and he plants the vineyard and he gets drunk and that whole story, the Torah calls him Ish Ha'adama, a man of the field, a man of the earth. Okay? Hold that thought. Moshe, when he runs away after killing the Egyptian and he has to flee, so he runs to Midian and there he meets the shepherds and he helps them out and they run home and dad says, why are you home so early? And they say, Ish Mitzri Hitzilanu, an Egyptian man saved us. So far, so good. Okay. They looked to him, to them, he looked like an Egyptian man, Ish Mitzri. But at the end of Moshe's life, where the Torah talks about the greatness, it calls him Ish Elokim, a godly man. Please note the direction in which each of them is going. Noach is Ish Tzadik and goes down to an Ish Ha'adama, a man of the earth. Moshe starts as an Ish Mitzri, an Egyptian man, and goes all the way up to become an Ish Elokim. The Midrash makes that contrast and compares them. There's many such points, and I guarantee if you do more homework, you'll find even more. I'm glad that it piqued your interest. Go ahead, next. Robin, you had your hand up.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, because this is sort of a counterpoint, so and I know we're supposed to be digging deep, and so I get what you're saying. I mean, I understood majority of it for digging deep, but I mean, if you look at it where like Moses is 10 generations from Noah, couldn't Moses just be an ancestor of Noah genetically? Doesn't have to have the same reincarnation.
You can say that, but I'm telling you what the Arizal tells us. The Arizal was a master.
Yeah, I was going to ask, who's the Arizal? That's what I'm saying. I don't know who that is.
Oh, okay, that's a fair question. The
Okay.
Arizal was Rav Yitzchak Luria. Rav Yitzchak Luria. He was in a couple of hundred, a few hundred years ago, was the absolute master of Torah secrets. He not only mastered what you and I have to study, the basic storyline, but he knew everything. And he was able to tap in. You know what Kabbalah is? You know what mysticism is? Well, you throw the word around, but what it is are, if you think I'm peeling back some layers, I got news for you. There are infinite numbers of layers of understanding of the Torah and how God interacts with the world. Again, significantly, I don't even come to the dirt under the fingernails. I'm like, it's nothing compared. He was a master and he understood. He had the ability to look at a person and to see into their soul and know exactly who they were. You're talking about one of the absolute greatest of all time. So when he writes a book, and it's not a book you and I just pick up and read casually. You can't learn this. It's not available for people like you and me. It's not available to me. I'm not holding out on you, Robin. It's the secrets of how deep this goes are shared with those who are ready. Einstein is not going to share his deepest understandings about quantum physics and then E equal MC squares with a numbskull like me. I don't know anything in physics. I'm just not primed for it. What the Arizal knew was all of this stuff. He knew factually that Moshe's soul had part as a reincarnated part of Noah. That's a fact on the table. So you can offer to say he's just a descendant, but so are every single human being is also a descendant of Noah because the world was destroyed.
Okay, so did this guy then write a book? Is that what you're saying? Is that how you
It's
found
not
this
a,
out?
it, I'm going to use the word book, but it's not anything you're going to find in the library. It's not anything you're going to find online. It's a sefer known as Sefer HaGilgulim. It's the book of reincarnation. It's a who's who of whose soul came from whom. And you and I are not in it.
No, I get that, but I mean, somebody, there's this.
It's not, Robin, you just have to trust me
Is
on
it a
this.
Talmud? Like,
This
is it
is,
a
this,
oral?
no.
It's
I'm
not an oral
telling you
tradition.
the word, listen, the word Kabbalah, and I don't want to get, again, it deserves its own class. What does the word Kabbalah really mean? Literal.
To
To
receiving.
receive. What a funny name. Why is it called to receive? That which is received. What does
Because
that mean?
that person could see it. Only this one person can get it, I guess, or whoever.
Nope. Nope.
Information that you
What?
receive. Information that you're receiving.
Yeah, but why would you name it, the whole study of it, as that which is received? Because it's an exclusive club. It's by invitation only. You have to be part of this line, deserving of receiving these traditions, of receiving these insights. They're not for the general populace because it will get ruined, it will get corrupted, it will get distorted. You know, you give someone, what's a good example? Here, it's not a great example, right? But everybody quotes the Zohar. The Zohar is the book of mysticism, right? I'm telling you folks, if you have any inclination to want to study the book of the Zohar, don't. Don't do it. You're gonna get it wrong. It's not written like a novel. It's not written in a way that a general, non-learned, super learned, uber learned person can understand. Yeah, you can read the words. It's like me trying to read, what did I read? Again, some of these really lofty ideas, I can translate every word, but I cannot understand what's being said. It's just so above my comprehension. So I'm going to go ahead and read it and I'm going to quote it and I'll be like, the guy, you're so off base. That's not at all what was meant. You have to know the rhythm, you have to know the style, you have to know what he's referencing. This is like, I don't know what comes after graduate program. What's higher than a graduate program?
Doctorate?
What?
After the doctoral program, you're saying?
Doctor, higher than that. Like, give me the absolute ultimate. It's higher than that. You
I get it.
don't let an undergrad read that kind of stuff because they're totally going to misuse it. And if it's just they don't understand because it's mathematics, okay, so no loss. But if you misrepresent or you misquote or you misunderstand something of Torah and you present it incorrectly, you are playing with fire. Can you imagine if, God forbid, somebody, not me, but somebody taught Torah and read it as follows? The first verse, I translate it as, in the beginning of God creating the heavens and earth. This person teaches it as, in the beginning, someone created God. And then he created heavens and earth. A person's welcome to do that, but that would be the most egregious transgression of translating the Torah. Imagine if that's how I taught it. Going ahead and reading books that are above our comprehension at this point, right? Continue learning. Maybe one day we'll get there. But you're playing with fire. You're reading stuff that not only doesn't make sense, you're gonna misunderstand it. And that's dangerous. So it's written, the entire concept of Kabbalah is written in code. I don't mean to cheapen it, I really don't. But it's the Nicolas Cage version of National Treasure. You gotta have a cipher and you have to have a way to read it. I mean, it's not just something you pick up and you, oh, that's what, oh, okay. Yeah, I get what the Zohar's saying. You can't.
I
You
get
have to
that.
be beyond well versed in Torah, beyond well versed in Talmud, beyond well versed in Mishnah, beyond well versed in Midrash, beyond well versed in Halacha, beyond well versed in everything. Then maybe you can get it. Maybe, then you can get an entry into the club.
I know Anne wants to say something, but
That's
just
who the Arizal was. That's
okay.
to paint the picture.
But then I'm that just the for quick follow-up, I get that whole concept is then how are you getting this information then?
I'm getting it because I've seen it quoted from sources that do understand it.
I gotcha. Okay. Thank you.
I do not read the Zohar. I can't make. Now, if I see it quoted, I like to look it up so that I can learn. But I would not have the audacity to sit here and to tell you, this is what I read, and here's how I originally, Zvi Tuchman, understands it. I cannot do that. It is
So the
way
concept of the
above.
reincarnation that came from
The
there.
same way that I can go ahead and teach in a class, Einstein says E=mc². I feel very confident in saying that, even though I have zero comprehension of it. But
Okay.
those who do have verified that that is an equation that explains
Oh,
whatever.
I see. So you're saying, and I don't know if I'm saying the name right. Eretzel, is that right?
The
Eretzel?
Arizal.
Oh,
Put the
Arizal.
emphasis on the R. Arizal.
Arizal. The Arizal said this, and that's what you're quoting. That's what.
Correct.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you. That makes a lot more sense because I wasn't sure where all that was coming from.
Yeah. Fred.
Few comments. I'll start with the first one in case I get stopped. Years ago, when Shoresh was sending rabbis to Beis Shalom on Sundays for talks, Rabbi Pasternak, I believe it was,
Yes.
gave the talk on reincarnation and the Book of Job. I videotaped that. If anyone would be interested in it, if you don't already have it, I'd be happy to give it to you. Get in touch with me somehow, or I can supply Rabbi E with a whole bunch of copies. Either way, it really goes into a lot of detail. And the other thing is what you're saying is that years and years and years ago, I had learned that you can't even be allowed to study Kabbalah or the Zohar until one, you are married, and two, you have a very firm education in Torah. I'll use Torah as a simple word, meaning everything that comes off of that. So in other words, you're not even supposed to study it. And you had to be 40 years old, I believe.
You're right, Fred. These are all general terms. And I don't want to spend
the rest of
the night on it because we could. Those are general guidelines, and they're not meant to be taken literally either. Let's take the 40, okay?
So,
people quote it all the time. Don't study Kabbalah until you're at least age 40. Let me ask you, does that really make any sense to you? When you turned 40, was there like a light switch that all of a sudden went on and you're like, oh, now I understand everything?
Oh, Rabbi, quickly. I mean, it is meant, basically it is saying, until you are ready to learn it, which is what you stated, do not even attempt it.
Correct.
People, probably when that was stated, don't forget, people didn't live, other than biblical time, they didn't live as long as we're living today.
It's even deeper than that, Fred. Yeah. I'll give you the quick primer, okay? Because if I didn't blow your brains enough, I'll keep going here.
Sorry, I got into this.
Listen to this, okay? Where does this number 40, Marty, this is in your up your alley, right? What's so unique about this number 40? We see it throughout Judaism. 40 is like one of the most primary numbers. Why? I'll just do it all on one foot because it's a whole class. There's God who is what we call Ein Sof, limitless, infinite. And then you have little old me who is the definition of finite. I am extremely limited. I'm extremely limited physically, emotionally, mentally, all my capabilities. I am limited. There is nothing about me except my soul, which comes from God, that is beyond just the finite. So how does God and the finite world have anything to do with each other? Is a poor analogy, right? For those of you in the computer world, a Mac and a PC. They're just two different languages. They just have almost nothing in common other than they're great computers, right? They talk completely different languages. So you need some kind of interface, some kind of system, program, whatever you want to call it, that converts one language to the other. The simple is I still am fascinated by a fax machine. Nobody uses them anymore, but it's a fascinating concept. I take a piece of paper that has writing on it, and I put it in a machine, and it converts it to nothing more than a bunch of zeros and ones. That's all it becomes. And it magically ends up in some other computer, some other machine that knows what zeros and ones it's telling it and can go ahead and print out that thing exactly what I sent it. It makes no sense. The only way it works is because it's translated into something that can be utilized by the receiving end. Yes? Okay. For God to interact with our world, it has to go through four transformations. Forget how I know it. Just for right now, okay? There's four levels of transformation. We know that the number 10 represents completion. God created the universe with 10 utterances. He gave us the Torah and 10 commandments. He destroyed the Egyptians with 10 plagues. 10 is one of those numbers that represents totality. If I'm telling you that when you want to have a complete transformation of something, from it to be from position A, completely changed 100%, it has to go through four levels, of which there are 10 levels each. Hence the number 40. The idea being that for God to give Moshe the Torah, Moshe needs to be 100% given the whole Torah. That requires 40 days. For the world to be destroyed, it had to rain down for the flood 40 days and 40 nights. For the Jewish people to be transformed from that slave coming out of Egypt, ready to finally go into Israel with the right mentality, they need 40 years. The spies went into the land of Israel to spy out the land, to get the totality, they went for 40 days. We can go through probably another 15 to 20 such examples. A mikvah, which is a transformation of status, whether it be for conversions or a woman with her cycle, it has to have 40 sa'a of water. 40, that's a measurement. The number 40, because it represents this idea of going through the four transformations with 10 subparts each. That's where. Now, Fred, when it says that you can't study Kabbalah until you're 40, it's not a magical thing. It means you have utilized the 40 years of your life being totally immersed, totally got the foundations of all of Torah. Now you're open to the suggestion you can take it to the next level. But you and me, I'll just say about me, I don't know about you, I'm not 40 anymore. I'm in my, okay? And I'm not even at the level of saying that I've utilized, I'm up to the 40. I'll be lucky if I got to 4. That's this concept. So yeah, for me, Robin, when the Arizal says something, for me, that's a fact. That's as good, if not better, than Einstein telling me, Tachman, you just don't know physics. Trust me, this is a proven fact. If the Arizal said it, it's gold for me.
The Arizal, though, was he was not a prophet. He was a rabbi.
He was super uber learned.
Was he a rabbi?
Yeah. Well, he didn't have a pulpit. He wasn't that kind of rabbi. I'm also a rabbi and I don't have a congregation, thank God. Mm-hmm. I thank Hashem every year.
But I know Anne had something she wanted to say.
Yes, please.
Go, Anne. You're
on mute.
You have to unmute. Unmute. We can't hear you.
Oh, I was just typing in the chat, but to the rabbi. But thank you for this amazing information. I think I understood a good part of it. But then I got lost, and I will welcome reviewing it.
So I will send out the recording of this.
Would
anybody who wants to review it?
And if I would like to be reincarnated several times.
No, you don't. So you don't want
that. I could begin to understand.
No, you don't want to be reincarnated. And get it right.
Well, I'm trying.
You're here for a reason.
I'm doing my best. Yes. I've gained some wisdom along the way.
That's great.
I think we all have to be as loving and kind as we can be to everybody.
No question about that. But yeah. It's not the goal in the Jewish religion. It's not the goal to get reincarnated. The goal is not to get reincarnated.
Okay.
It's to finish the job.
Do it right the first time.
Yeah,
I'll take
or whatever time we're up to.
I just want to have time, you know.
Yeah.
Because there's so much to learn.
Yeah. I'll just tell you this, if it's not enough for you, Robin. The Arizal does write, and I've seen it quoted, not that I've seen it, but I've seen it quoted from very reliable sources, this idea of reincarnation, that he said this in his time. Okay, and it's in this a few hundred years ago. Just about everybody nowadays is a reincarnated soul. Very, very, very few, if any, are originals. Which makes perfect sense to me, my little puny brain. Because everybody I've spoken to, and everybody here, tell me, have you ever had a deja vu moment?
No.
Okay? I think everybody. It's not hocus pocus. It's not. It's because we've been here before. We have been here. This is not the first experience for us. We are reincarnated souls. There's a good side to this. The silver lining is that means we didn't start at zero. Our job, maybe, our job is to bring it to the finish line. It got the previous versions got us to the 98th percentile. Maybe our job is just to bring it home. That's our job.
Rabbi, isn't there a finite number of souls? I was told that
there may be a finite number of souls, but who says they're not divisible?
Well, that's true too, but that's the reason
there are, according to the Talmud, there's 600,000 root souls.
Okay.
Obviously, there's got to be more than 600,000 souls because there's more than 600,000 of us.
I remember many years ago when you talked about us, the soul, and we were all in the soul train, man.
Yeah, we're not there yet. We're not there yet. Not until we leave this earth. We are not at the, we're not on that soul train yet.
I have many books on Kabbalah. I finally found, I said, I wonder if there's one for dummies. Believe it or not, there is.
There
I
is.
think on one, I actually, page one, I did understand. Page two, I was completely lost. So, I mean, and we even took a class down here in Frederick on the Kabbalah. And even the rabbi said, I'm with you on this. The first time I've looked at it, I'm not sure if I understand it either.
What I share with you when I say in Kabbalah, I don't really mean Kabbalah. I mean the way it's been brought down into a level that we can comprehend. It's we only talk, I mean, again, nothing personal, right? I don't think you or me are at a level anything higher than Kabbalah for Dummies. We're just not. We're not there. We're
Agree with
not
you 100%.
versed enough. We're just
Susan
not
wants to talk, I
knowledgeable
think. Here,
enough.
Susan. She's being patient. Look at Susan.
Yes, but whatever. I can go on and
Susan's
on.
being
Go ahead,
very patient with
Susan.
her hand up. Look at
I just want to say that you did, Rabbi Svi, you did not disappoint me in returning us to the
Yeah,
Garden of
Garden
Eden
of Eden.
story again. I
Yeah.
just want to
Yeah,
say I'm grateful.
I don't do it on purpose.
I know, but that's we got there and just in the second class. So yeah,
But I mean, the second parsha was one removed, so
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to pause. I'm going to stop it here, but I'll send out the recording. Yes, if you want to send me an email, it's very simple. It's rabbit, RA. I'll put it in the chat. I'll put it in the chat. If you want to e email me, that's fine. Rabbit@shoresh.com. Rabbit, Rabbi T, rabbit@shoresh.com. Nice and easy. Okay, if nothing else, a lot of food for thought. Okay, all right. I will, God willing, see you next week. Let me just confirm that. Make sure.